I was depressed. I quickly lost confidence in what I was saying. The professor realized it and, looking at me ironically, asked me to talk about something I had read recently. I suppose he meant something by an Italian writer, but I didn't understand and clung to the first support that seemed to me secure. That is to say, the conversation we had had the summer before on Ischia, on the beach of Chitara, about Beckett and about Dan Rooney, who, although he was blind, wanted to become deaf and mute as well. The professor's ironic expression changed slowly to bewilderment. He cut me off quickly and delivered me to the history professor. He was just as bad. He subjected me to an endless and exhausting list of questions formulated with the utmost precision. I had never felt so ignorant as I did at that moment, not even in the worst years of school, when I had done so badly. I was able to answer everything, dates, events, but only in an approximate way. As soon as he pressed me with even more exacting questions, I gave up. Finally, he asked me, disgusted, "Have you ever read something that is not simply the school textbook?" I said, "I've studied the idea of nationhood." "Do you remember the name of the author of the book?"
"Federico Chabod."
"Let's hear what you understand." He listened to me attentively for several minutes, then abruptly dismissed me, leaving me with the certainty that I had said a lot of nonsense. I cried and cried, as if I had carelessly lost somewhere the most promising part of myself. Then I said that despair was stupid. I had always known that I wasn't really smart. Leela, yes, she was smart. Nino, yes, he was smart. I was only presumptuous and had been justly punished. Instead, I found out that I had passed the exam. I would have a place of my own, a bed that I didn't have to make at night and unmake in the morning, a desk and all the books I needed. I, Elena Greco, the daughter of the porter, at 19 years old, was about to pull myself out of the neighborhood. I was about to leave Naples by myself. 81. A series of whirlwind days began. A few things to wear, a very few books. My mother's sullen words. "If you earn money, send it to me by mail. Now who's going to help your brothers with their homework? They'll do badly at school because of you. But go, leave, who cares? I've always known that you thought you were better than me and everybody else." And then my father's hypochondriac words. "I have a pain here. Who knows what it is? Come to your papa, Lenou. I don't know if you'll find me alive when you get back." And then my brother's and sister's insistent words. "If we come to see you, can we sleep with you? Can we eat with you?" And Pasquale, who said to me, "Be careful where all this studying leads, Lenou. Remember who you are and which side you're on." And Carmen, who couldn't get over the death of her mother and was fragile, started crying as she said goodbye. And Alfonso, who was stunned and murmured, "I knew you'd keep studying." And Antonio, who instead of listening to what I was saying about where I was going and what I was going to do, kept repeating, "I'm really feeling good now, Lenou. It's all gone. It was going into the army that made me ill." And then Enzo, who confined himself to taking my hand and squeezing it so hard that it hurt for days. And finally, Ada, who said only, "Did you tell Lena? Did you tell her?" And she gave a little laugh and insisted, "Tell her, she'll die of envy." I imagined that Leela had already heard from Alfonso, from Carmen, from her husband, whom Ada had certainly told, that I was going to Pisa. If she didn't come to congratulate me, I thought, it's likely that the news really has disturbed her. On the other hand, if she didn't know, to go deliberately to tell her, when for more than a year we had scarcely said hello, seemed to me out of place. I didn't want to flaunt the good fortune that she hadn't had. So I set aside the question and devoted myself to the last preparations. I wrote to Nella to tell her what had happened and ask for the address of Maestra Oliviero so that I could give her the news. I visited a cousin of my father who had promised me an old suitcase. I made the rounds of some of the houses where I had taught and where I had to collect my final payment. It seemed to me an occasion to give a kind of farewell to Naples. I crossed Via Garibaldi, went along the Tribunali, at Piazza Dante took a bus. I went up to the Vomero, first to Via Scarlatti, then to the Santarella. Afterward, I descended in the funicular to Piazza Amedeo. I was greeted with regret and, in some cases, affection by the mothers of my students. Along with the money, they gave me coffee and almost always a small gift. When my rounds were over, I realized that I was a short distance from Piazza dei Martiri. I turned onto Via Filangieri, uncertain what to do. I recalled the opening of the shoe store. Lila, all dressed up like a rich lady. How she was gripped by the anxiety of not having truly changed, of not having the same refinement as the girls of that neighborhood. I, on the other hand, I thought, really have changed. I'm still wearing the same shabby clothes, but I've got my high school diploma, and I'm about to go and study in Pisa. I've changed not in appearance, but deep inside. The appearance will come soon, and it won't be just appearance. I felt pleased with that thought, that observation. I stood in front of an optician's window. I studied the frames. Yes, I'll have to change my glasses. The ones I have overwhelm my face. I need lighter frames. I picked out a pair with large, round, thin rims, put up my hair, learned to use makeup. I left the window and arrived at Piazza dei Martiri. Many shops at that hour had their shutters lowered halfway. The Salata's was three quarters down. I looked around. What did I know of Lila's new habits? Nothing. When she worked in the new grocery, she didn't go home for lunch, even though the house was nearby. She stayed in the shop and ate something with Carmen, or talked to me when I came by after school. Now that she worked in Piazza dei Martiri, it was even more unlikely that she would go home for lunch. It would be pointless, besides the fact that there wasn't enough time. Maybe she was in a cafe, maybe walking along the sea with the assistant she surely had. Or maybe she was inside resting. I knocked on the shutter with my open hand. No answer. I knocked again. Nothing. I called. I heard steps inside. Lila's voice asked, "Who is it?" "Elena." "Lenu," I heard her exclaim. She pulled up the shutter. She appeared before me. It was a long time since I'd seen her, even from a distance, and she seemed changed. She wore a white blouse and a tight blue skirt. Her hair and makeup were done with the usual care. But her face was as if broadened and flattened. Her entire body seemed to me broader and flatter. She pulled me inside, lowered the shutter. The place, gaudily illuminated, had changed. It really did seem not like a shoe store, but like a living room. She said, with a tone of such genuineness that I believed her, "What a wonderful thing has happened to you, Lenu, and how happy I am that you came to say goodbye." She knew about Pisa, of course. She embraced me warmly. She kissed me on both cheeks,
her eyes filled with tears. She repeated, "I'm really happy." Then she called, turning to the door of the bathroom.
"Come, Nino. You can come out. It's Lenucha."
My breath failed. The door opened and Nino appeared, in his usual pose, head lowered, hands in pockets. But his face was furrowed by tension. "Hello," he murmured. I didn't know what to say, and offered him my hand. He shook it without energy. Leela, meanwhile, went on to tell me many important things in a brief series of sentences. They had been secretly seeing each other for almost a year. She had decided for my good not to involve me further in a deception that, if discovered, would cause trouble for me as well. She was 2 months pregnant, and she was about to confess everything to Stefano. She wanted to leave him.
82. Leela spoke in a tone I knew well, of determination, with which she strove to eliminate emotion, and she confined herself to rapidly and almost disdainfully summarizing events and actions, as if she were afraid that allowing herself merely a tremor in her voice or lower lip would cause everything to lose its outlines and overflow, inundating her. Nino sat on the couch looking down, making, at most, a nod of assent. They held hands. She said that their meetings there in the shop, amid all the anxieties, had ended the moment she had the urine analysis and discovered the pregnancy. Now, she and Nino needed their own house, their own life. She wanted to share with him friendships, books, lectures, movies, theater, music. "I can't bear living apart anymore," she said. She had hidden some money and was negotiating for a small apartment in Campi Flegrei, 20,000 lire a month. They would hide there, waiting for the baby to be born. How? Without a job? With Nino who had to study? I couldn't control myself. I said, "What need is there to leave Stefano? You're good at telling lies. You've told him so many. You can perfectly well continue." She looked at me with narrow eyes. She had clearly perceived the sarcasm, the bitterness, even the contempt that those words contained behind the appearance of friendly advice. She also noticed that Nino had abruptly raised his head, that his mouth was half open, as if he wanted to say something. But he contained himself in order to avoid an argument. She replied, "Lying was useful in order not to be killed, but now I would prefer to be killed rather than continue like this." When I said goodbye, wishing them well, I hoped, for my sake, that I wouldn't see them again.
83. The years at the Normale were important, but not for the story of our friendship. I arrived at the university very timid and awkward. I immediately realized I spoke a bookish Italian that at times was almost absurd, especially when, right in the middle of a much too carefully composed sentence, I needed a word and transformed a dialect word into Italian to fill the gap. I began to struggle to correct myself. I knew almost nothing about etiquette. I spoke in a loud voice. I chewed noisily. I became aware of other people's embarrassment and tried to restrain myself. In my anxiety to appear friendly, I interrupted conversations, gave opinions on things that had nothing to do with me, assumed manners that were too familiar. So I endeavored to be polite but distant. Once, a girl from Rome, answering a question of mine I don't remember what about, parodied my inflections, and everyone laughed. I felt wounded, but I laughed too, and gaily emphasized the dialectal accent as if I were the one making fun of myself. In the first weeks, I fought the desire to go home by burrowing inside my usual meek diffidence. But from within that, I began to distinguish myself and gradually became liked. Students, male and female, janitors, professors liked me. And though it might have appeared effortless, in fact, I worked hard. I learned to subdue my voice and gestures. I assimilated rules of behavior, written and unwritten. I kept my Neapolitan accent as much under control as possible. I managed to demonstrate that I was smart and deserving of respect by never appearing arrogant, by being ironic about my ignorance, by pretending to be surprised at my good results. Above all, I avoided making enemies. When one of the girls appeared hostile, I would focus my attention on her. I was friendly yet restrained, obliging but tactful, and my attitude didn't change, even when she softened and was the one who sought me out. I did the same with the professors. Naturally, with them I behaved more circumspectly, but my goal was the same, to be appreciated, to gain approval and affection. I approached the most aloof, the most severe, with serene smiles and an air of devotion. I took the exams as scheduled, studying with my usual fierce self-discipline. I was terrified by the idea of failing, of losing what immediately seemed to me, in spite of the difficulties, paradise on earth, a space of my own, a bed of my own, a desk, a chair, books and more books, a city a world away from the neighborhood and Naples. Around me, only people who studied and who tended to discuss what they studied. I applied myself with such diligence that no professor ever gave me less than an A. And within a year, I became one of the most promising students whose polite greetings could be met with kindness. There were only two difficult moments, both in the first few months. The girl from Rome who had made fun of my accent assailed me one morning, yelling at me in front of other girls that money had disappeared from her purse and I must give it back immediately or she would report me to the dean. I realized that I couldn't respond with an accommodating smile. I slapped her violently and heaped insults on her in dialect. They were all frightened. I was classified as a person who always made the best of things, and my reaction disoriented them. The girl from Rome was speechless. She stopped up her nose, which was bleeding. A friend took her to the bathroom. A few hours later, they both came to see me, and the one who had accused me of being a thief apologized. She had found her money. I hugged her, said that her apologies seemed genuine, and I really thought so. The way I had grown up, I would never have apologized, even if I had made a mistake. The other serious difficulty had to do with the opening party, which was to be held before Christmas vacation. It was a sort of dance for the first-year students that everyone essentially had to attend. The girls talked about nothing else. The boys, who lived in Piazza dei Cavalieri, would come. It was a great moment of intimacy between the university's male and female divisions. I had nothing to wear. It was cold that autumn, it snowed a lot, and the snow enchanted me. But then I discovered how troublesome the ice in the streets could be. Hands that, without gloves, turned numb. Feet with chilblains. My wardrobe consisted of two winter dresses made by my mother a couple of years earlier, a worn coat inherited from an aunt, a big blue scarf that I had made myself, a single pair of shoes with a half heel that had been resoled many times. I had enough problems with my clothes. I didn't know how to deal with that party. Ask my classmates? Most of them were having dresses made just for the occasion, and it was likely that they had something among their everyday clothes that would have been fine for me. But after my experience with Leela, I couldn't bear the idea of trying on someone else's clothes and discovering that they didn't fit. Pretend to be sick? I was tempted by that solution, but it depressed me. To be healthy and desperate to be a Natasha at the ball with Prince Andrei or Koryagin, and instead to be sitting alone, staring at the ceiling, while listening to the echo of the music, the sound of voices, the laughter. In the end, I made a choice that was probably humiliating, but that I was sure I wouldn't regret. I washed my hair, put it up, put on some lipstick, and wore one of my two dresses, the one whose only merit was that it was dark blue. I went to the party, and at first I felt uncomfortable. But my outfit had the advantage of not arousing envy. Rather, it produced a sense of guilt that encouraged camaraderie. In fact, many sympathetic girls kept me company, and the boys often asked me to dance. I forgot how I was dressed, and even the state of my shoes. Besides, that night I met Franco Mari, a rather ugly but very amusing boy with a quick intelligence, insolent and profligate. He was a year older than me, and from a wealthy family in Reggio Emilia, a militant communist, but critical of the party's social democratic leanings. I happily spent a lot of my little free time with him. He gave me everything. Clothes, shoes, a new coat, glasses that didn't obscure my eyes and my whole face, books about politics, because that was the subject dearest to him. I learned from him terrible things about Stalinism, and he urged me to read Trotsky. As a result, I developed an anti-Stalinist sensibility and the conviction that in the USSR, there was neither socialism nor even communism. The revolution had been truncated and needed to be started up again. He took me on my first trip abroad. We went to Paris, to a conference of young communists from all over Europe. I hardly saw Paris. We spent all our time in smoky places. I was left with an impression of streets much more colorful than those of Naples and Pisa. Irritation at the sound of the police sirens, and amazement at the widespread presence of blacks on the streets and in the meeting rooms. Franco gave a long speech in French that was much applauded. When I told Pasquale about my political experience, he wouldn't believe that I... "Really? You?" he said, "had done a thing like that." Then he was silent, embarrassed, when I showed off my reading, declaring that I was now a Trotskyite. From Franco, I also got many habits that were later reinforced by the instructions and conversations of some of the professors. To use the word study, even if I was reading a book of science fiction, to compile very detailed note cards on every text I studied, to get excited whenever I came upon passages in which the effects of social inequality were well described. He was very attached to what he called my re-education, and I willingly let myself be re-educated. But to my great regret, I couldn't fall in love. I loved him. I loved his restless body. But I never felt that he was indispensable. The little that I felt was gone in a short time, when he lost his place at the Normale. He failed an exam and had to leave. For several months we wrote to each other. He tried to re-enter the Normale. He said that he was doing it only to be near me. I encouraged him to take the exam. He failed. We wrote occasionally. And then, for a long time, I had no news of him. 84. This is more or less what happened to me between the end of 1963 and the end of 1965. How easy it is to tell the story of myself without Leela. Time quiets down, and the important facts slide along the thread of the years, like suitcases on a conveyor belt at an airport. You pick them up, put them on the page, and it's done. It's more complicated to recount what happened to her in those years. The belt slows down, accelerates, swerves abruptly, goes off the tracks. The suitcases fall off, fly open, their contents scatter here and there. Her things end up among mine. To accommodate them, I am compelled to return to the narrative concerning me, and that had come to me unobstructed, and expand phrases that now sound too concise. For example, if Leela had gone to the Normale in my place, would she ever have decided simply to make the best of things? And the time I slapped the girl from Rome, how much did her behavior influence me? How did she manage, even at a distance, to sweep away my artificial meekness? How much of the requisite determination did she give me? How much did she dictate even the insults? And the audacity when, amid a thousand doubts and fears, I brought Franco to my room. Where did that come from, if not from her example? And the sense of unhappiness when I realized that I didn't love him, when I observed the coldness of my feelings. What was its origin, if not, by comparison, the capacity to love that she had demonstrated and was demonstrating? Yes, it's Leela who makes writing difficult. My life forces me to imagine what hers would have been if what happened to me had happened to her. What use she would have made of my luck? And her life continuously appears in mine, in the words that I've uttered, in which there's often an echo of hers, in a particular gesture that is an adaptation of a gesture of hers, in my less, which is such because of her more, in my more, which is yielding to the force of her less. Not to mention what she never said, but let me guess, what I didn't know and read later in her notebooks. Thus, the story of the facts has to reckon with filters, deferments, partial truths, half-lies. From it comes an arduous measurement of time past that is based completely on the unreliable measuring device of words. I have to admit, for example, that everything about Leela's sufferings escaped me. Because she had taken Nino, because with her secret arts she had become pregnant by him and not by Stefano, because for love she was on the point of carrying out an act inconceivable in the environment we had grown up in, abandoning her husband, throwing away the comfort so recently acquired, running the risk of being murdered along with her lover and the child she carried in her womb. I considered her happy, with that tempestuous happiness of novels, films, and comic strips, the only kind that at that time truly interested me. That is to say, not conjugal happiness, but the happiness of passion, a furious confusion of evil and good that had befallen her and not me. I was mistaken. Now I return to the moment when Stefano took us away from Ischia, and I know for certain that the moment the boat pulled out from the shore, and Leela realized that she would no longer find Nino waiting for her on the beach in the morning, would no longer debate, talk, whisper with him, that they would no longer swim together, no longer kiss and caress and love each other, she was violently scarred by suffering. Within a few days, the entire life of Signora Caracci, balances and imbalances, strategies, battles, wars and alliances, troubles with suppliers and customers, the art of cheating on the weight, the devotion to piling up money in the drawer of the cash register, dematerialized, lost truth. Only Nino was concrete and true, and she who wanted him, who desired him day and night, who clung to her husband in the darkness of the bedroom to forget the other even for a few minutes. A terrible fraction of time. It was in those very moments that she felt most strongly the need to have him, and so clearly, with such a precision of detail, that she pushed Stefano away like a stranger and took refuge in a corner of the bed, weeping and shouting insults, where she ran to the bathroom and locked herself in. 85. At first she thought of sneaking out at night and returning to Furio, but she realized that her husband would find her right away. Then she thought of asking Alfonso if Marisa knew when her brother would return from Ischia, but she was afraid that her brother-in-law would tell Stefano she had asked that question, and she let it go. She found in the telephone book the number of the Saratore house, and she telephoned. Donato answered. She said she was a friend of Nino. He cut her off in an angry tone, hung up. Out of desperation, she returned to the idea of taking the boat, and had nearly made up her mind when, one afternoon in early September, Nino appeared in the doorway of the crowded grocery, unshaved and totally drunk. Lila restrained Carmen, who had jumped up to chase out the disorderly youth, in her eyes a crazy stranger. "I'll take care of it," she said, and dragged him away. Precise gestures, cold voice, the certainty that Carmen Peluso hadn't recognized the son of Saratore, now very different from the child who had gone to elementary school with them. She acted fast. She appeared normal, like a woman who knows how to solve every problem. In truth, she no longer knew where she was. The shelves stacked with goods had faded. The street had lost every definition. The pale facades of the new apartment buildings had dissolved. But most of all, she didn't feel the risk she was running. Nino, Nino, Nino. She felt only joy and desire. He was before her again, finally, and his every feature loudly proclaimed that he had suffered and was suffering, had looked for her and wanted her, so much that he tried to grab her, kiss her on the street. She took him to her house. It seemed to her the safest place. Passers-by? She saw none. Neighbors? She saw none. They began to make love as soon as she closed the door of the apartment behind her. She felt no scruple. She felt only the need to grab Nino immediately, hold him, keep him. That need didn't diminish even when they calmed down. The neighborhood, the neighbors, the grocery, the streets, the sounds of the trains, Stefano, Carmen, waiting, perhaps anxious, slowly returned. But only as objects to be arranged hastily, so that they would not get in the way, but with enough care so that, piled up haphazardly, they would not suddenly fall. Nino reproached her for having left without warning him. He held her tight. He still wanted her. He demanded that they go away immediately, together. But then he didn't know where. She answered, yes, 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 and shared his madness in everything. Although, unlike him, she felt the time, the real seconds and minutes that, slipping by, magnified the danger of being surprised. So, lying with him on the floor, she looked at the lamp hanging from the ceiling just above them like a threat. And if before she had been preoccupied only with having Nino right away, no matter what might come crashing down, now she thought about how to keep him close to her without the lamp detaching itself from the ceiling. Without the floor cleaving in two, with him forever on one side, her on the other. Go. No. You're mad.
Yes. Please, I'm begging you. Go.
She convinced him. She waited for Carmen to say something, for the neighbors to gossip maliciously, for Stefano to return from the other grocery and beat her. It didn't happen, and she was relieved. She increased Carmen's pay. She became affectionate toward her husband. She invented excuses that allowed her to meet Nino secretly. 86. At first, the larger problem was not the possibility of gossip that would ruin everything, but him, the beloved. Nothing mattered to him except to clutch her, kiss her, bite her, penetrate her. It seemed that he wanted, that he needed, to live his whole life with his mouth on her mouth, inside her body. And he couldn't tolerate the separations. He was frightened by them. He feared that she would vanish again. So he stupefied himself with alcohol. He didn't study. He smoked constantly. It was as if, for him, there was nothing in the world but the two of them. And if he resorted to words, he did it only to cry to her his jealousy, to tell her obsessively how intolerable he found it that she continued to live with her husband. "I've left everything," he murmured wearily, "and you don't want to leave anything."
"What are you thinking of doing?" she then asked him.
Nino was silent, disoriented by the question, or he became enraged, as if the situation offended him. He said desperately, "You don't want me anymore." But Leela wanted him again and again. But she also wanted something else, and right away. She wanted him to return to studying. She wanted him to continue to stimulate her mind the way he had on Ischia. The phenomenal child of elementary school, the girl who had charmed Maestra Oliviero, who had ridden the blue fairy, had reappeared and was stirring with new energy. Nino had found her under the pile of dirt where she had ended up and pulled her out. That girl was now urging him to be once more the studious youth he had been and allow her to develop the power to sweep away Signora Caracci, which she gradually did. I don't know what happened. Nino must have perceived that in order not to lose her, he had to be something more than a furious lover. Or maybe not. Maybe he simply felt that passion was emptying him. The fact is that he began studying again. And Leela at first was content. He slowly recovered, became as she had known him on Ischia, which made him even more essential to her. She had again not only Nino, but also something of his words, his ideas. He read Smith unhappily. She too tried to read it. He read Joyce even more unhappily. She tried too. She bought the books that he mentioned to her, the rare times they managed to meet. She wanted to talk about them. There was never a chance. Carmen, who was increasingly bewildered, didn't understand what could be so urgent when Leela, with one excuse or another, was absent for several hours. She observed her frowning, so immersed in reading a book or writing in her notebooks, that she seemed not to see or hear anything. As she left the burden of the customers to Carmen, even during the grocery's busiest hours, Carmen had to say, "Lena, please, can you help me?" Only then did she look up, run a fingertip over her lips, say yes. As for Stefano, he fluctuated between anxiety and acquiescence. While he quarreled with his brother-in-law, his father-in-law, the Saladas, and was upset because, in spite of all that swimming in the sea, children didn't come, here was his wife being sarcastic about the troubles with the shoes, and wrapped up in novels, journals, newspapers until late into the night. This mania had returned, as if real life no longer interested her. He observed her. He didn't understand, or didn't have the time or the wish to understand. After Ischia, a part of him, the most aggressive, in the face of those alternating attitudes of rejection and peaceful estrangement, was inciting him to a new clash and a definitive explanation. But another part, more prudent, perhaps afraid, restrained the first, pretended not to notice, thought, better like this than when she's being a pain in the ass. And Leela, who had grasped that thought, tried to make it last in his mind. At night, when they both returned home from work, she was not hostile toward her husband. But after dinner and some talk, she withdrew cautiously into reading, a mental space inaccessible to him, inhabited only by her and Nino. What did he become for her in that period? A sexual yearning that kept her in a state of permanent erotic fantasy, a blazing up of her mind that wanted to be at the same level as his. Above all, an abstract plan for a secret couple, hiding in a kind of refuge that was to be part bungalow for two hearts, part workshop of ideas on the complexity of the world. He present and active, she a shadow glued to his footsteps, cautious prompter, fervent collaborator. The rare times that they were able to be together not for a few minutes but for an hour, that hour was transformed into an inexhaustible flow of sexual and verbal exchanges, a complete well-being that, at the moment of separation, made the return to the grocery and to Stefano's bed unbearable. I can't take it anymore.
Me neither.
What can we do?
I don't know.
I want to be with you always.
Or, at least, she added, for a few hours every day. But how to carve out time, safe and regular? Seeing Nino at home was extremely dangerous. Seeing him in the street, even more so. Not to mention that at times Stefano telephoned the grocery, and she wasn't there, and to come up with a plausible explanation was difficult. So, caught between Nino's impatience and her husband's complaints, instead of regaining a sense of reality and telling herself clearly that she was in a situation with no way out, Leela began to act as if the real world were a backdrop or a chessboard, and you had only to shift a painted screen, move a pawn or two, and you would see that the game, the only thing that really counted, her game, the game of the two of them, could continue to be played. As for the future became the day after, and then the next, and then the one after that. Or sudden images of massacre and blood, which were very frequent in her notebooks. She never wrote, "I will die murdered," but she noted local crime news. Sometimes she reinvented it. In these stories of murdered women, she emphasized the murderer's rage, the blood everywhere. And she added details that the newspapers didn't report. Eyes dug out of their sockets, injuries caused by a knife to the throat or internal organs, the blade that pierced a breast, nipples cut off, the stomach ripped open from the belly button down, the blade that scraped across the genitals. It was as if she wanted to take the power away even from the realistic possibility of violent death by reducing it to words, to a form that could be controlled. 87. It was in that perspective of a game with possibly mortal outcomes that Leela inserted herself into the conflict between her brother, her husband, and the Salata brothers. She used Michele's conviction that she was the most suitable person to manage the commercial situation in Piazza dei Martiri. She abruptly stopped saying no, and after quarrelsome negotiations, as a result of which she obtained absolute autonomy
and a substantial weekly salary, as if she were not Signora Caracci, she agreed to go and work in the shoe store. She didn't care about her brother, who felt threatened by the new Salotta brand and saw her move as a betrayal, or about her husband, who at first was furious, threatened her, then drove her to complicated mediations in his name with the two brothers concerning debts contracted with their mother, sums of money to receive and to give. She also ignored the sugary words of Michele, who constantly hovered around her to supervise, without appearing to, the reorganization of the shop, and at the same time pressed to get new shoe models directly from her, passing over Reno and Stefano. Lila had perceived for a long time that her brother and her father would be swept away, that the Salottas would appropriate everything, that Stefano would stay afloat only if he became more dependent on their dealings. But if before that prospect made her indignant, now, she wrote in her notebooks, the situation left her completely indifferent. Of course, she was sad about Reno. She was sorry that his role as a boss was already declining, especially since he was married and had a child. But in her eyes, the bonds of the past now had little substance. Her capacity for affection had taken a single path. Every thought, every feeling had Nino at its center. If before her motivation was to make her brother rich, now it was only to please Nino. The first time she went to the shop in Piazza dei Martiri to see what to do with it, she was struck by the fact that on the wall where the panel with her wedding photograph had been, you could still see the yellowish-black stain from the flames that had destroyed it. That trace upset her. "I don't like any part of what happened to me and what I did before Nino," she thought. And it suddenly occurred to her that there, in that space at the center of the city, and for reasons that were obscure to her, every crucial development in her war had occurred. There, the evening of the fight with the youths of Via dei Mille, she had decided conclusively that she had to escape poverty. There, she had repented of that decision, and had defaced her wedding photograph, and had insisted that the defacement, as defacement, should be featured in the shop as a decoration. There, she had discovered the signs that her pregnancy was about to end. There, now, the shoe enterprise was failing, swallowed up by the Salottas. And there, too, her marriage would end. She would tear off Stefano and his name, along with all that derived from it. "What a mess," she said to Michele Salotta, pointing out the burn marks. Then she went out to the sidewalk to look at the stone lions in the center of the square, and was afraid of them. She had it all painted. In the bathroom, which had no windows, she reopened a walled-up door that had once led to an interior courtyard and installed a half-window of frosted glass that could let in some light. She bought two paintings that she had seen in a gallery in Chiatamone and had liked. She hired a sales girl, not from the neighborhood, but a girl from Mater Dei, who had studied to be a secretary. She arranged that the afternoon closing hours, from 1 until 4, should be for her and for the assistant a period of absolute repose, for which the girl was always grateful. She held off Michele, who, although he supported every innovation sight unseen, nonetheless insisted on knowing the details of what she was doing, what she spent. In the neighborhood, meanwhile, the decision to go to work in Piazza dei Martiri isolated her more than she already had been. A girl who had made a good marriage and had gained, out of nowhere, a comfortable life. A pretty girl who could be mistress of her own house, a house owned by her husband. Why did she jump out of bed in the morning and remain far from home all day, in the city, employed by others, complicating Stefano's life and her mother-in-law's, who, because of her, had to go back to work in the new grocery. Pinuccia and Giliola especially, each in her own way, threw on Lila all the mud they were capable of, and this was predictable. Less predictable was Carmen, who adored Lila for all she had done for her, but who, as soon as Lila left the grocery, withdrew her affection as if she were pulling back a hand grazed by an animal's claws. She didn't like the abrupt change from friend-colleague to servant in the clutches of Stefano's mother. She felt betrayed, abandoned to fate, and couldn't control her resentment. She even began to argue with her fiancé, Enzo, who didn't approve of her bitterness. He shook his head and, in his laconic way, rather than defend Lila, assigned her, in a few words, a sort of inviolability, the privilege of having reasons that were always just and indisputable. "Everything I do is no good. Everything she does is good," Carmen hissed bitterly.
"Who said so?"
"You. Lina thinks. Lina does. Lina knows. And I, whom she went off and left there? But naturally she was right to leave, and I am wrong to complain. Is it true? Is that what you think?"
"No."
But in spite of that pure and simple monosyllable, Carmen wasn't convinced. She suffered. She sensed that Enzo was tired of everything, even of her, and this enraged her even more. Ever since his father died, since he had returned from the army, he did what he had to do, led his usual life. But meanwhile he was studying at night, he had started during his military service, to get some sort of diploma. Now he was shut up in his head, roaring like a beast, roaring inside, outside silent. And Carmen couldn't bear it. She especially couldn't stand that he became a little animated only when he talked about that bitch. And she shouted at him and began to cry, screaming, "Lina makes me sick because she doesn't give a damn about anyone, but you like that, I know. Well, if I acted the way she acts, you'd smash my face." Ada, on the other hand, had long since aligned herself with her employer, Stefano, against the wife who harassed him. And when Lila went to the center of town to become the luxury saleswoman, she simply became more treacherous. She said bad things about her to anyone, openly, straight out. But she was angry mainly with Antonio and Pasquale. "She has always taken you in, you men," she said, "because she knows how to get you. She's a whore." She said it just like that, irately, as if Antonio and Pasquale were the representatives of all the insufficiency of the male sex. She insulted her brother, who didn't side with her. She screamed at him, "You're silent because you take money from the Saladas, too. You're both employees of the company, and I know you're ordered around by a woman. You help her put the shop in order. She says move this and move that, and you obey." And she was even worse with her fiancé, Pasquale, with whom she was increasingly at odds, constantly criticizing him, saying, "You're dirty. You stink." He apologized. He had just finished work. But Ada continued to attack him, every chance she got, so that Pasquale, to live in peace, gave in on the subject of Lila. The alternative was to break the engagement, although, it should be said, that was not the only reason. He had often been angry with both his fiancé and his sister for having forgotten all the benefits they had gained from Lila's rise. But when, one morning, he saw our friend in the Giulietta with Michele Salada, who was driving her to Piazza dei Martiri, dressed like a high-class prostitute, all made up, he admitted that he couldn't understand how, without a real economic need, she could sell herself to a man like that. Lila, as usual, paid no attention to the hostility that was growing around her. She devoted herself to the new job, and soon sales rose sharply. The shop became a place where people went to buy, but also to chat with that lively, very pretty young woman, whose conversation sparkled, who kept books among the shoes, who read those books, who offered you little chocolates along with the intelligent talk, and who, moreover, never seemed to want to sell Cerullo shoes or Salata shoes to the wife or daughters of the lawyer or the engineer, to the journalist for Mattino, to the young or old dandy who was wasting time and money at the club. Rather, she wanted them to make themselves comfortable on the couch and the ottomans and chat about this and that. The only obstacle, Michele. He was often in the way during work hours, and once he said in that ironic, insinuating tone he had, "You have the wrong husband, Lena. I was right. Look how well you move among the people who can be useful to us. You and I together in a few years would take over Naples and do what we like with it." At that point, he tried to kiss her. She pushed him away. He wasn't offended. He said in amusement, "That's all right. I know how to wait." "Wait where you like, but not here," she said. "Because if you wait here, I'll go back to the grocery tomorrow." Michele's visits diminished, while Nino's secret visits increased. For months, he and Lila had, finally, in the shop on Piazza dei Martiri, a life of their own, which lasted for 3 hours a day, except Sundays and holidays, and those were unbearable. He came in through the door of the bathroom at 1 o'clock, as soon as the assistant pulled the gate 3/4 of the way down and went off. And he left by that same door at 4, exactly before the assistant returned. On the rare occasions that there was some problem, a couple of times Michele arrived with Giliola, and there were particularly tense situations when Stefano showed up, Nino shut himself in the bathroom and sneaked out by the door that opened to the courtyard. I think for Lila that was a tumultuous trial period for a happy existence. On the one hand, she enthusiastically played the part of the young woman who gave the shoe store an eccentric touch. On the other, she read for Nino, studied for Nino, reflected for Nino. And even the people of some prominence with whom she became acquainted in the shop seemed to her mainly connections to be used to help him. During that period, Nino published an article in Il Mattino on Naples that gave him modest fame in university circles. I didn't know about it, and luckily, if they had included me in their story as they had on Ischia, I would have been so severely scarred that I would never have managed to recover. And it wouldn't have taken me long to figure out that many of the lines in that article, not the most erudite, but those few intuitions that did not require great expertise, only an inspired moment of contact between things that were very distant from one another, were Lila's, and that the tonality of the writing in particular belonged to her. Nino had never been able to write in such a fashion, nor was he able to later. Only she and I could write like that. 88. Then she discovered that she was pregnant and decided to put an end to the deception of Piazza dei Martiri. One Sunday in the late autumn of 1963, she refused to go to lunch at her mother-in-law's, as they usually did, and devoted herself to cooking with great care. While Stefano went to get pastries at the Salata's, bringing some to his mother and sister to be forgiven for his Sunday desertion, Lila put in the suitcase bought for her honeymoon some underwear, a few dresses, a pair of winter shoes, and hid it behind the door of the living room. Then she washed all the pots that she had gotten dirty, set the table in the kitchen, took a carving knife out of a drawer and put it on the sink, covered by a towel. Finally, waiting for her husband to return, she opened the window.